Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast whose life doesn't make any sense, but whose does. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Todd.
And I'm your plastic groom who's fun to be with, now with multiple marital attachments.
Well, the stars have never existed, the universe has been destroyed, and it's been a long time since we could get away with ending an episode with a brief shot of some scary floor tiles. So what the hell could possibly happen next? Let's find out as we discuss the Big Bang.
So one of our listeners, Nick H. at Heisenberg Pod, asks us this question. Please explain the season-ending two-parter. I do not get it at all.
That's because he lives in an uncertainty principle.
Well, on that note, Nathan, please explain.
Okay, I'm going to do it in third. No, I'm not going to do it.
I can have a go. So Goscinny and Uderzo wrote and directed last week's episode, including the Cleopatra piece. It really was. And this week's one is more Warner Brothers. As scribble comedy. Actually feels like Myrna Loy and William Powell and Carol Lombardo, because it's me and I'm on the podcast, but, you know, this is what we talk about. But you can see the pace and the direction. Moffat's really playing with his film history and everything he loves in his box of delights.
I get a real Sapphire and Steel vibe
really?
From it. Yeah.
But I was awake for this one.
It's shorter, yeah, and funnier, but it takes place in a sort of eccentric space. I mean, we'll talk about the opening a little bit later, but most of the stuff in that museum happens in a world where the rules don't normally apply. And the way that Moffat achieves this is by inventing the total – what is it? Not the total perspective
total
vortex.
Total event collapse. Yeah.
You remember Matt was a complex space-time event in Time of Angels, and now we've got perfect, you know, better than Bidmead, technobabble here. Total event collapse does what it says on the tin. But basically what it means is that rules don't apply. And so we exist in this sort of weird world that is sort of our world, but it's a world where there's no stars, where there's no sun, where history is gradually unhappening around them. And all of that sort of strange time thing and the emphasis on historical artifacts and stuff seems to me classic Sapphire and Steel.
I feel it's classic Douglas Adams.
There's a lot of Douglas Adams
in this. I actually feel that Moffat is in his own manic manner, which is always more frenetic than Adams, even at his most Parisian. Adams was never quite as frenetic as this storytelling is, but I really do feel it's his thinking. Who's been the best story writer? I feel this is more a picking. These last two episodes have been picking over the history of Doctor Who for the Christmas box best bits.
We certainly saw that last week with all the sort of, you know, Daypole minifigures sort of collected at the end. I mean, the Adams thing, Moffat owes a lot to Adams because Adams does the puzzle box plot with time travel, and not so much in Doctor Who, but certainly in Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, which is absolutely constructed like that, where a whole heap of inexplicable events happen and then there's time travel and they're sort of explained, and plus jokes. And also the rebooting the universe out of a small amount of matter that was in the Pandorica seems to me like the total perspective vortex.
It really
extrapolating
is. A little
the universe.
Bit of fairy cake.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think when Nick's asking sort of what happens, it's exactly that. It's kind of like Ghostlight in that everything you need to know about what is happening in this episode happens in an info dump in one scene. It's the scene just before the Doctor gets shot by the Dalek when he explains inside the Pandorica are all these molecules from the beginning of the universe. We've seen that the light from the Pandorica revives things, so let's just turn it up to 11. Actually surprised they didn't use that line.
Yeah.
But I do have to wonder then, what made all the stars blow up in the first place?
Well, that's a total event collapse. That's what that is.
Okay.
But, in the dictionary, Brendan.
The stars, not the planets.
Well, no, because Earth survives, but I suppose with the stars exploding at every point in their history, they probably never generated planets. A lot of planets.
If it's every point in history.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're an anomaly. They're at the eye of the storm. So the only reason the Earth exists, the Earth couldn't have existed in this reality, but the only reason it exists is because it did exist.
Yeah.
And it's the eye of the storm and it's magic. You see, there are enough kind of space reasons given for the people who want there to be some sort of coherent scientific thing that they can hang their hat on. Mm. But basically, this works on the logic of a fairy tale and it works with magic, and that's how the story is resolved.
It's funny that, like, Rory says, no, not getting it. Yeah. And I actually, as I sat there, I went, well, me, finally getting it 11 years later. Like, all the answers are there, or he set everything up, and whether you like the space reasons or buy them or whatever, for somebody like me who wants everything answered, they are there, but you've just got to accept some of them are more magic than science. Yeah. And I think it's your perspective on what you think science fiction or Doctor Who actually is.
Yeah, I headcanon that the reason the stars exploded is because the TARDIS exploded, and the TARDIS has been everywhere in the universe. So if it's exploding at every point in the universe, the TARDIS blew up all the stars.
Yeah, well, I think that's clear that that's what's happening.
Yeah. Although I will say that watching it this time through is the first time I understood why, when River opens the TARDIS doors, there's a block of concrete in front of them, because the Doctor says the TARDIS has sealed off the control room and River in a pocket dimension.
Ah, made of concrete.
And put her in a time loop. So at the point of the explosion, she loops back a few seconds, so she never gets blown up, but the rest of the TARDIS does. And it's like, okay, no, I can accept that.
But again, magic, I think.
Hashtag space reason.
So we begin.
Yeah.
1894 years later. So with young Amy. Am I correct?
Yeah. So it's little Amelia. In fact, the first shot there is the first shot of series 5. Mm. So what happens here, I think, is that Amy gets a do-over. We see what happens when she runs off with her imaginary friend the night before her wedding. It ends in catastrophe. It ends with the universe blowing up.
That'd be a salutary lesson. Wayward girls.
That's it. When you're an adult, nothing good happens after midnight. Sorry, turn left.
Yeah, or before midnight, really. But now she gets a do-over, right? The Doctor never comes. And so she does that prayer and she goes up to the window expecting the Doctor to be there. But instead of hearing the sort of wheezing, groaning sound, all we hear is the sound of the wind. And so this is a world where the Doctor never came for her. And because of that, it's a world that has no stars and no magic, you know, and she's trying to hold on to that because that's Amy, but instead she lives in a much bleaker and more desolate world where the Doctor never shows up. Hmm. Mind you, he turns up 4 minutes in because he can't help himself.
But, and needs to invite her to the museum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Her aunt gives up on her in that, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Lost Child Museum, well, whatever.
Yeah. I'll go back tomorrow. Maybe she'll be there.
Yeah. It reminds me of this short film I saw when I was a kid, and I don't know if it was like a public service announcement or something, but a brother and sister get locked overnight in a supermarket and they have to eat the frozen food and what have you. And it was Australian. I remember it was Australian. But I remember as a kid going, hasn't their mum or dad like called up and said, I last saw them in the supermarket. Can someone go in and look?
Yeah, they've cracked open a couple of bottles of red, I would think.
Yeah.
Enjoying the quiet.
Yeah, Aunt Sharon's clearly like, quiet night. No little ginger talking about stars. Mm-hmm. I can live with this.
Mm. Also, I think, too, it's an answer to the kind of objection that the doctor's sort of driven her mad in the original timeline because she's visiting all those psychologists and biting them and stuff like that. That's a thing that still happens in this version where the doctor doesn't show.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Maybe not as much. She seems quite cool and collected and she follows the procedure and she, I mean, all she ever does is I'm thirsty. It's not really, really difficult behavior for an 11-year-old. It's all... No, I think just Auntie Sharon is a cow.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
We don't see her again, do we? Does she burn very brightly?
She is at the wedding.
She's at the wedding.
She's at the wedding, right at the back.
But, you know,
with Neris.
In this pre-credits teaser, obviously, we've got post-it notes and the soda stolen and stick around pond and all of that's going to come back later on in the episode.
Again, it's front-loading it. It's a puzzle box because we open the Pandorica expecting to see the doctor inside and it's Amy and she says, all right, kid, this is where it gets complicated. And it's already fairly complicated. Like we've seen clearly the doctor has snatched her drink. We know that the doctor's left the notes. It's the red pen from the lodger. It's all sort of this sort of careful, complex setup where we don't see the reasons for any of the things that happen. And then we end with this sort of big surprise that can't possibly be true. And then he will go back after the credits, which don't come in until sort of seven and a half minutes again, and give us every reason for all of those things that happen.
There's also Stephen doing what he does now with two-parters where you just don't have a direct continuation like what Russell would or classic Doctor Who. You know, he throws us in at some point and those answers are going to happen at some point through the episode. He's going to explain what's going on, but you're sort of thrown by where you're at and what's actually going on. Did you guys think it was going to be Amy even when she touched the Pandorica?
No, absolutely not.
Not originally, no. And that was a lovely bit. Although it's all predicated, isn't it? Oh, she has to live. How will she live? Put her in the fridge.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great surprise and sort of very deliberately that.
Or a disappointment, depending on your position as the viewer. Is that too harsh?
And then we go 1894 years previously with Rory talking to dead Amy and a ridiculous miracle happens.
I think I said this last week and I just want to reiterate. I don't know what it is, but somehow Stephen Moffat manages to write a man shooting his girlfriend in the stomach and not have it be utterly horrific. It is disturbing and upsetting, but I think
it is Amy, though.
I think, though, even last week, because it's so ridiculous, like Rory shoots Amy, then the Doctor gets locked in a box, then the entire universe explodes, then we pull out to reveal all the stars exploding. I think at that point you go, well, obviously they're going to get out of this. This isn't series 9.
See, I can see Tom having huge fun with this, but I can see David Tennant just being quite cross with it all. Wouldn't have been
Rory!
Yeah.
But it is quite fun. I think, like you're comparing to Douglas Adams and the humour and the wit of Stephen Moffat to give you answers, but to have that in there so that you're not disturbed by the fact that Rory has shot Amy in the stomach and the doctor coming back with the fez and the mop and all of that ridiculousness and you're sort of chuckling away at what's going on and that, I think is marvellous.
It is a moment of great despair, though, isn't it? And I think that's because Arthur Darvill really carries the scene.
Oh, yes. Mm.
He's so
I don't think it would have worked if it was anyone else in the cast.
Mm. Mm. And immediately when we hit that despair, something ridiculous happens. And the one thing I had never noticed before is that he appears three times, and the first time he has the mop and the fez. The second time he doesn't have the mop.
Mm.
I didn't actually notice that before, and it's one of those sort of continuity errors. You know, you might have thought it was a continuity error,
yeah,
except when we replay it from the other end, you yes see him deliberately putting the mop down so that yeah he doesn't appear with the mop in the second thing. And all of that is setting us up for the moment where the Doctor is going to jump back in time and appear and then die. And so when that happens, we're already primed to be aware that things happen to the Doctor in this episode in the wrong order. And so it's gently set up for us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that last week, Rory coming back, which we thought was the point of all that talk about if you can remember something, it can come back. Rory comes back and we think, okay, we understand that. And so when the Doctor comes back at the end of this episode, we're already primed to understand how that works.
Mm. I like all of the dialogue with Rory about the Nestines, and there's quite a lot of explanations there about him, you know, being more than just a Nestine duplicate. And it's stuff that I missed the first time around. I think I keep saying it, when you come back to Stephen Moffat episodes, you can keep coming back and finding new stuff year after year after year.
There's density like there is with Adam's writing as well. Yeah, there's things. I don't think he's as fun. Well, he is fun. He's as fun, and he certainly has a manic quality, more so than Douglas Adams, surprisingly. But I don't know that his complexity is as fluid. And Adam's story, you can't, you can see it's perfectly whole. There's no, really no other way this could have gone within its own tenets. But when you look at a Moffat thing, I'm thinking, you're writing this at 4 a.m, aren't you? And you're really, and the adrenaline's a lot of fun, but you're really just edging it.
I think the paradox probably is Douglas Adams seems to write character first and then sees what weird stuff he can fit in around that.
Ah, yes.
Whereas Stephen Moffat, I think, is very much a plot-first writer. He wants the plot to make as much sense as possible, and then he inserts the characters into it. So whereas Douglas Adams, if you like, is coming up with the theme park ride first, whereas Stephen Moffat's going, yes, but what are the engineering tolerances of the roller coaster?
I mean, Moffat's characters are very clearly drawn. Like, you know how Amy and Rory and the Doctor are going to react to things, but that doesn't make them realistic.
No. Oh, goodness, no. Well, it's the Sarah Jane principle again, in that if these characters were realistic, they would stay home. They would not be putting up with this week after week,
yeah,
especially next year.
What would Harry and Sarah have done in a similar situation?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is that there's much less whimsy in season 12.
Mm.
It's really sort of grueling and bleak and sort of horrendous and kind of realistic, sort of action-adventure realistic, in that it's sort of drawing from Nazism and stuff like that all the way through. And so when we did season 12 and we were all on it together, I think, we kept observing just how awful this is and how are these people going through this, and why does Sarah get back on board the TARDIS at the end of Terror of the Zygons? Why doesn't she sort of punch him in the face and run screaming away from him?
Which is the big difference, because in this one they actually do like each other.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it seriously, I think Harry would have gone to make a cup of tea for 2,000 years, but just leave her.
Talking about that point of 2,000 years, I think that's just a beautiful moment. I just love, I had tears the first time through. I still get emotional when it talks about him guarding that and the night of the Blitz or whatever, and he's not being seen. I adore that. But then again, I adore Rory and Arthur Darvill.
Yeah, I mean, it's his penance for shooting Amy, isn't it? Like, he has to be, in order to still be a good guy, he has to kind of go through that. But again, it's sort of very well told in the two time periods. So we see it being set up, being decided in 102 AD. And then we hear Nicholas Briggs telling us, I'm assuming it's Nicholas Briggs, telling us all about it in the museum 1900 years later.
Mm. Getting so many little windows into the Moffat virtue own home life.
It is amazing how it takes Rory 1900 years to go, you know what, maybe I'll get rid of the skirt. Hey. Maybe I'll get some modern clothes.
I thought they were plastic, which is why you stay in them. Yeah.
Bold vision of the future, and it never needs ironing.
But here at the museum, we've got Amy and Amelia. They get to hug each other or hold each other's hands. Isn't there some sort of effect that's supposed to happen
the
with that?
The Blinovich limitation effect, but total event collapse, I'm afraid, trumps it.
Yeah, that's my thinking as well. But the sonic screwdrivers do spark when they touch each other.
Yeah.
But that is 2,000 years ago, so maybe 2,000 years later the universe is so small that the Blinovich limitation effect doesn't happen anymore.
Yes, maybe that's it. I mean, they don't annihilate each other.
They don't annihilate each other. No reapers appear. they don't, you know, short out and kill a bunch of immortals and give Nicholas Courtney a nervous breakdown. No, none of that.
Did you notice the doctor's advice to Rory, which is stay away from radio signals when they come because they'll make him suffocate Katie Manning?
It's very subtle, isn't it? I noticed it this time around. I went, goodness, that's such a nod to the
He just says radio signals, doesn't he?
Yeah. Heat and radio signals.
Heat and radio signals.
Yeah.
And then he says, and stay out of, and it could have
been Daffodil Factory.
It could be anything. And then when he appears in the present, he says the word trouble. So, you know, again, we've got that idea that the events are playing out over two time streams, absolutely rammed home so that you don't miss what's going on.
There's a couple of moments around here. Matt's look, or the doctor's look, on his face as Amy and Rory continue to kiss and hug is just hilarious.
Breathe.
I love Amy's little Amelia's take on it too. And he's definitely, it's one of those lovely moments, and there's many of them in these two episodes, where you can see the doctor is the 11-year-old person watching the events of these so-called adults and just finding it all very untidy.
Yes.
That drink is, of course, circular. It's a paradox. Like, the reason that she needs a drink and asks for one is that he took it away in the teaser and she wouldn't have been thirsty if he hadn't done that. So there's no actual reason for that to happen. And that is just stuck in there by Moffat because he can. Yeah. Like, there's no doubt that he knows that that's what he's doing.
Proper clever clogs.
Could I just say, like, I'm a walking cliche. I really disliked it the first time around. I thought, yes, you're so clever that the doctor appears, you know, because the doctor appears in the past to get himself out of the Pandorica, then, oh, look, I've lost the plot. I'm sorry. But do you know what I'm saying? Like, the fact that he has to come back from the future to get himself out of the past, but in the past. I just still can't explain it. It does my head in. I'm just struggling to explain any of it that right now, and I don't know how Nathan's going to even edit that. But I do think it's very clever and it works wonderfully well, and I think you can get away with it once.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think this is a great moment. It is a great moment. I really do enjoy it, even though it just does my head in.
Look, I mean, he doesn't reach for it all that often. And like a normal sort of non-event episode will happen sort of in a linear way and won't have the Doctor sort of nipping back to fix things sort of Bill and Ted style in order to get out of something. And maybe that would be tedious, but certainly I think it's fun when it does happen here.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And how good does the Paradigm Dalek look in stone?
Oh. Isn't it lovely? And we've not seen that finish yet, have we? It's a brand new one.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm looking forward to, well, we've had bronze.
Yep.
And we've had Duco. Now we've got, I can't wait for barnacles on their bottom for the seafaring episodes to come up next year.
Well, that one that came out of the river in Dalek Invasion of Earth, that's probably got barnacles.
Barnacles on its bottom.
But it's very nice to have a Dalek in the season finale because, you know, we have to keep up that tradition as much as we possibly can, even though we've had a few where they haven't been there, but, you know,
make more finales. Boring. With,
Well, I was actually initially disappointed by this episode. I had the Todd experience because...
Back in the day,
yeah. Really?
Title.
Todd experience. It's only good things.
I've got to say, I did too. I just thought it was messy and you're pulling all the strings out and it just felt like the 11th hour panic attack that you've got a script due. And when Russell did it, because we've seen this a lot in the last... however many years we've been doing this show, Russell was doing it constantly. Maybe there was something that Brendan said in this Douglas Adams style and that the characters always came first, and in this one it's plot. So even though we're familiar with them and we do love the people that are in it and that's what saves it, it's not the impetus for the action. So in any of the Russell Van der Sea Aeklers, because they are that big, it's about the character and what's happening with the characters first and foremost. I still think the best one is the Dalek two-parter at the end of Eccleston's first only series. That really makes it all work. Yeah, maybe that's why you weren't so captivated.
It's not actually. The reason is that I was after a big, dumb spectacle. And instead...
I wanted bang.
I did. And instead I had four people talking in a museum.
I was promised a big bang.
Yes, exactly. It's in the title. And so even though the universe has been destroyed, like really comprehensively, I mean, it's a bigger end of episode 12 catastrophe than we've ever had. Suddenly we're all just sort of standing around talking.
Mm. But that's what Stephen Moffat does. He doesn't do the big, huge...
No.
Spectacles in these episodes, he brings it back to his core cast, and you tend to have less periphery cast around and other things going on. And,
yeah.
But I actually do think this is his season. This is what has been in his head for a very long time, and I do think that it is actually very well constructed and plotted out. And again, to harp on, it's like going back and rereading the novel and coming up with new... or seeing all the answers for the first time, or seeing answers that were already there in plain sight but you missed them because you were concentrating on other things and had other expectations perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember watching this in 2010 and the scene where Amelia disappears, I remember my exact thought was, this is the introspective finale.
Yeah.
So all of Russell's finales, as you say, it's big bangs, the world is coming to an end, there's things flying in the sky, shooting lasers. Whereas Stephen Moffat, I think, makes a conscious decision of, I'm sure I could do more of the same. I'm sure I could do that. But it's going to invite comparison anyway to what the last four series have been. I am going to do something that is harder to directly compare.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to have the big universal stakes. And, yeah, you know, he does six season finales. And I would say four of them are this kind of introspective, focusing on the lead characters and their relationships with each other with a very small guest cast. Now, here, because in the last episode we had a bunch of Romans and this episode we've got a wedding, it's not as noticeable as some of his later ones. Yeah. But it's still noticeable. And for me, I was watching that and I kind of went, oh, okay, it's not going to be a big alien invasion story, but I can accept that because it's consciously making that decision and it doesn't feel like Stephen Moffat going, oh, no, I can't do that, because eventually he will do that and it'll be good. But it's more Stephen Moffat going, I'm a fan. I know what fans are like. If I try and do Russell's thing, people will either Gallifrey base will be split asunder by people saying that Moffat did it better or Russell did it better, and they'll have to close it down for a few days again. So rather than that, I'm going to do something that plays to my strengths and do something that focuses on basically my three regulars and my recurring character, River Song.
So the other thing is that all of Davey's finales, once the big dumb spectacle is over, have a big character moment. And often that's because we've got a cast change or whatever at the end. But it's things calm down a bit and then we have time to see where the characters all are as a result. Whereas this one, you know, we talk about the plot being the most important thing here, but in many ways the most important thing is Amy. And I've been saying this all year. This is the story where Amy decides to accept being an adult, and I haven't said this before, you know, the idea of a woman getting married as a the most important sign of adulthood is obviously a problem. But yes, and the sort of problem that is only going to get worse next year, I think. But in any case, she accepts her adulthood and then says, no, actually, that's not enough. Mm. I want childhood as well, and calls the doctor back into existence. And so that's the point of this. And Moffat's finales are much, much more centered around the characters and what's happening to the characters, even if they are sort of science fiction things like the hybrid or being turned into a Cyberman or something like that. Something very serious centers the story on the characters in a way that, you know, Daleks Invade Canary Wharf isn't about any of the characters particularly.
Mm.
But I guess with all the Russell finales, there is, like, you know, there's somebody leaving every year in a different way, and that happens right at the end after that big spectacle. So
Russell's always been writing dark, hasn't he? He's always been writing It's a Sin.
Yeah.
Ever since Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
He just thought it was fun and jolly because it was Doctor Who. No, it really wasn't.
No.
Nothing this nice ever happens to people in Russell's universe.
Yeah.
This is actually nice at the end.
Yeah.
People are happy, Russell.
And
go on to nice lives, Russell.
In regards to people leaving sort of once a year, now having the complete RTD era and the complete Moffat era to look back on, as a producer who decides the cast, Russell is actually quite ruthless because series one, obviously Christopher Eccleston leaves, so Billy Piper has to stay on, but they did film an ending where Rose died and they did plan another ending where Rose left. Then Rose leaves at the end of series two. Freema is contracted for half of series four, but they decide the character's not working, so write her out of Doctor Who and have her as a guest role elsewhere. And Catherine Tate, they wrote her out without even asking whether she would have continued because they realized they were having so much fun, but they're like, oh, we've already written her out. But then afterwards they said to her, oh, we would have loved you to stay on. She's like, of course I would have stayed on. Why didn't you ask me?
Yeah.
So Russell kind of goes, okay, no, I have my unit of the companion story that is being told and then you're out.
Yeah.
Whereas twice Moffat has his companions, writes a perfect ending for them, but then the actor wants to stay on. So he's like, oh, okay, on you go. Arguably to their detriment.
Yeah.
But I've noticed a symmetry to this episode surrounding the companions. So the story starts with Amelia / Amy, then Rory is in the story, then the Doctor is in the story, then River disappears, and the Doctor's going back through his timeline, and then we end on Amy and Rory, and then the last shot of the episode before the TARDIS flies off into the opening title sequence, which is amazing, is Amy looking up.
Mm.
It's got this pyramid structure.
But is it diegetic?
Well, something I did notice that's diegetic in that symmetry is when Amelia disappears in the foyer of the museum, Rory runs down the stairs shouting, Amelia, Amelia. Then the Doctor from the future appears at the top of the stairs, falls down. They run upstairs, do all the thing. When they come back down, the dying Doctor is gone and Rory runs down the stairs screaming, Doctor, Doctor.
Right.
It's very nice.
It's very nice. And I think Arthur Darvill even faces left, then faces right in both occasions.
Right.
See, that is how clever Stephen Moffat is, and you don't always see that until somebody like yourself points it out and you think, oh my goodness. Like,
absolute uber fan child.
Can I just say something at this point? I do get annoyed with Matt Smith having to talk into the ear of that very bad Dr. Double. Like, it just takes me out of that moment every single time. I go, that is not Matt Smith. The hair is all wrong.
That's Edward Watts's bum from Edmund Watt.
Well, have you seen the guy in the Doctor Who Confidential who's Matt Smith's double?
No.
He's like twice his age.
Everyone is twice his age.
That's true. But yeah, he's Matt Smith's stunt double. He did the horse riding.
Oh,
last week. Yeah.
He kicked all the goals. Harsh but fair.
And Caitlin Blackwood, but we don't.
Hey!
That's why Matt needed a new stunt double next year.
That's you if you ever go into television front of camera.
What, me, Caitlin Blackwood?
Well, we've seen you do the frocks. Actually, who wants to see, write in, dear listener, if you want to see Brendan do Amelia Pond. it's a thing now. Say it three times quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Brendan, he's doing it. You're doing it now, aren't you, love? You're doing it
I'm
now.
I'm wearing it now.
So after we get rid of the dead fake doctor.
Dead wood. Oh, no, that's Russell.
We go up to the roof.
Yes.
And I didn't pick it that the sun was going to be the TARDIS.
No.
We haven't had River. We get that wonderful line, or what sort of time do you call this when the doctor actually appears in the TARDIS?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he says, hi, honey, I'm home. I mean, they're, and that's the thing too, the mystery of who River is. Could she possibly be the doctor's wife? Guess what?
actually.
And that's the Moffat approach. Missy is the master. Like, who else could she be? He just, these mysteries not fun to resolve, and so he resolves them in the most obvious way.
Could it have been the Mistress Romana?
Yes, please. Yes, please. But this is the thing. Is Paul Cornell talking to Stephen Moffat now? Because this is – we've done it. We've said it so many times before, haven't we? This is Benny.
It
really, really is Benny, to the point that why do we need a River Song?
I just listened to an episode of Doctor Who, The Writer's Room, where they did Time Worm Revelation, and they were constantly drawing parallels between Cornell and Moffat's concerns.
And Stiles, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And they were friends, and, you know, they got to know each other over the writing series.
They just hiss like cats when they pass each other now.
Did they go to tavern together and stuff?
Yeah, they did.
They knew each other for a while. And so a lot of the stuff that Moffat does is stuff that Cornell did during the wilderness years as well.
Yeah, very well. You can see this is, I was actually going to say, I'm really enjoying these lovely fanfic productions that the BBC is kindly donating cash to the last few years. Yeah. And this just feels like another one of them. Mm-hmm. This is honestly all the lads who are, and it is mostly lads, we really need to say, to the point that it'd be nice to see a lady writer.
Maybe once. It is something that Moffat became very conscious of towards the end of his time and went to some lengths to try and rectify. And then I think Chibnall has taken that even further by hiring more female directors and writers than sort of ever before.
Yeah, even in the 90s we had a Kate Orman, didn't we?
We did.
We did.
Getting increasingly annoyed with each passing novel that she was the only woman writing yes. for the range, and her about the author section. What even has Kate Orman is still the only woman to have written a new adventure. Drums, fingers. I think that's on the back of Sleepy.
But I can see that Moffat saying, right, rubbing his hands together, just as Russell did, right, now we can do everything at once.
Yeah.
So is that the sense that you're getting from this episode? It's all my Christmases at once.
Well, I mean, the new adventures did do the time things. You know, the Doctor going back, there are a few new adventures that end with the Doctor going back to put things in place so that
very
the previous
so.
Story works.
See, Brendan's probably read them more recently than the rest of us.
Oh, I'm stuck on the pit at the moment.
Well.
But at the
we call it the pit.
That's Neil's one.
We just did the hands, dear listener.
I don't think I ever got through that.
No, terrible.
I'm thinking of just putting it down so I can move on to Deceit, I think is next.
Yeah, I didn't finish it either.
You will have the same experience with Deceit.
Fair enough. I can't remember who it's doing, but I will send you the link, Nathan. There has just been a fan production of The Pit released, so I may just listen to that because it's going to be better than the novel.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Can I bring things back to the roof?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the Doctor and River obviously get out of the TARDIS with the time vortex manipulator. So she's up there with Amy in the plastic Centurion, her parents, right?
Yeah.
Which, sorry, spoiler alert, but it's like at this point in time, Alex Kingston wouldn't have known.
I wonder if Moffat knew. Maybe he knew.
I don't know. It always annoys me a little that you never get any sort of subtle thing where she'll give a slight look or something, knowing that they are her parents. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I mean, if you told the actress, it would, of course, then influenced her performance. But I just kind of sometimes feel like
I agree
that River's ability to completely not give anything away is just too good an act.
Yeah.
But, you know, she does get to say, what in the name of sanity have you got on your head?
Yeah. I love that.
Well, and that
I miss
is,
the Fez. I love
it. Oh, the Fez is so great. But it is that thing where she's his wife and he's an idiot and she doesn't want him to look like an idiot. And so she puts a stop to him. Like, both of the women, like, doesn't Amy take the Fez and throw it in the air so that River can shoot it? Yep. And then that will happen at the beginning of next year with the Stetson as well.
Yeah.
She's constantly intervening to stop her husband looking like an idiot in public. And it's the most wifely thing that I can kind of imagine.
On the topic of whether Alex Kingston knew or not, in Babylon 5, which of course, Nathan, you've never heard
of.
Yeah,
what is it?
Of course, that had a 5-year story arc, but the actors were never informed of what the story arc was because the writer JMS said, if you know that your character will eventually lead to the downfall of your civilization, you might play that early on. And the whole point of your character is they think they're doing the right thing and it leads them down this dark path.
This is Hellenic theatre.
Well,
isn't
it?
The gods cannot divulge.
Yeah. And I think
the gods have been canine because he's the Deus Ex.
Canis Ex Machina.
I am your daughter.
I'm your what?
Daughter.
Can you imagine John Leeson in these scenes? Alex Kingston. It'd be fantastic.
I think it would be literally no different at all.
Dr. Banks, for mercy, I am canine.
Oh, Nathan, we're not going to do any canine impersonations. I'm going to leave it up to the two professionals here.
But the other thing about whether Moffat knew at this point is he has since said the title The Big Bang is a direct reference to This Is the Night That Melody Was Conceived.
I really did not want to know.
But no, he said when he was thinking of a title, he came up with that title thinking of Amy and Rory's honeymoon rather than Big Bang 2. And then he remembered, I've got the Big Bang 2 in the script.
I thought that the party was a Big Bang as well. And yeah, that was a sort of the double meaning.
It's a nice reading.
Yeah. It's absolutely a sitcom relationship, isn't it? They get married and then have sex and then she gets pregnant immediately.
Yeah.
You know, it's classic sort of collapsing of time.
It's WandaVision, isn't it?
And you know, the thing where you come back next season and the baby is like, you know, can talk and stuff like that. Like, again, absolute sort of sitcom stuff. Yeah.
And they've avoided the awkward point where they have to put Karen Gillan in a lab coat with tools that she never uses, despite the fact she's that's Voyager.
I like that we keep looping back to the roof just like it's the episode.
Well, that is the fulcrum point
Todd
of the episode.
Todd still hasn't had his roof moment. Go on.
What are you talking about?
We keep coming back to the roof.
Well, we're now
going to
go down from the roof. And we're
did we work out why the TARDIS has taken 16 billion years to explode?
Because it's all happening at the same time. At
that's
every
quantum
point
field
in history.
Theory.
Yeah.
The quantum field exists all at once.
Also magic.
Much like this podcast.
And space reasons.
And I just listened to The Hollows of Time this week by Christopher Hamilton Bidmead, which has a quantum gravity engine, but it's basically just space reasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is...
You'll never come on this podcast, you know, if you talk like that.
I mean, this is Bidmedian. This is like the collapse of the architecture in Castrovalva as Castrovalva folds in on itself.
I love that,
And it's also like that eccentric space in Warrior's Gate.
Yes.
So there's a very sort of Bidmedian feel to this, and that's a good thing. But unlike Bidmead, Moffat acknowledges that essentially this is just magic, that you can recreate things that have been lost through memory and so on. You know, the reason Rory comes back not as a plastic Auton is because Amy really loved him and remembered him very well.
But magic is just science unexplained.
Well, no, magic is manipulating symbols in order to manipulate reality. It's
got to Oprah now. No, I'm serious. Yeah. We've actually got to New Age. I don't know how hippie woo-woo Moffat really is. I suspect he isn't. But all of this contemplation is the New Age spiritualism, the Eckhart Tolle, the things we don't tend to talk about on the podcast. Everything you've just talked about is how they discuss how the New Age, and it's a big thing and a lot of people are into it now. It's not just a little, not just a little fringe thing anymore. But, you know, New York Times bestsellers. Yeah, and Carolyn Miss and all of those folk, they talk about the quantum field as being everything relevant and everything happening at once. And that is why wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
And there's a lot, look at, there's a lot of people who have done it. Made a lot out of if you believe in it hard enough and you push yourself, you truly pursue it, it will come to you.
And if you like to surf and turf in that order.
But it's also the logic of narrative where you can use words and manipulate symbols in order to create a world and make events happen. And Moffat is all about story. And as a storyteller, he has the power to bring something back that's been forgotten. And I think... Is it the doctor? It's Amy realizes that the doctor was trying to get her to sort of bring him back into being through her words at the wedding. And that's absolutely magic. That's conjuring, you know.
But let's go back to the roof. So we've gone up the ladder to the roof, but now we're coming back down. And it's River versus the Dalek, which I just... adore that scene.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of a parallel to the doctor, you know, look me up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Mercy with the Dalek. Yeah. And then, of course, Amy and Rory discover that the doctor is not lying on the steps. And River says, well, the doctor lies, rule one. So yeah. We're coming back to something that Stephen's been setting up for some time.
Can we talk about the confrontation with the Dalek, though?
Sure.
It's amazingly well shot. So you've got Dutch angles, you've got the camera moving in on both of them, and it is clearly intended to set up the themes of the next season by having her just kill a Dalek in cold blood. And, you know, shooting Daleks, I think, is a fine thing to do. You know, it seems perfectly moral to me. But here it is a sign that she's a bit of a psychopath.
Yeah.
And she taunts it. She torments it.
It's the gloating. It's not necessarily the act of killing the Dalek itself because but
she's the doctor
Daleks
in
is
this.
What you do.
Well, she's the ninth doctor in this one.
Yeah, well, but the Dalek has killed her husband just now. I mean, you know, like has shot him dead. Mm. And so, you know, I'd be annoyed.
Back to Greek theatre again, aren't we?
Yeah, she's allowed to take revenge. It's proper.
But we get down to the Pandorica, and I love the way Matt, the lighting, and how he's shot while he's in that.
Yes.
Lovely bluey green.
Yeah.
Doesn't he look like Prince Philip?
He really does. Like
not
he does
right now.
But, you know, just the whole conversations down there, explanations like, you know, the Pandorica, a restoration field powered by an exploding TARDIS at every point in history and you know, talking to Amy about, you know, the girl who waited and bringing back all, you know, talking to her about the mum and dad, you know, I lost my mum and dad. There's just so much richness in the explanations and what's going on. It's pulling everything together, unless you may not agree with me.
No, no. I think
right.
The really interesting moment is the moment that Amy realizes for the first time that she doesn't know what happened to her parents. Mm. And because it's never come up in the narrative, we assume that there's a real story that we don't know about. But that's not how narrative works. There's no real world. There's no fact of the matter. And so the fact that it's never been mentioned what happened to her parents ends up being a sign that no one actually knows.
Yeah.
And we've seen the crack in her wall suck people up and no one remembers them.
Yeah.
Right back in sort of episode 5. And so that's where we discover what happened to Amy's parents. But it's Moffat does this all the time. And in a way that I think annoys people who love the Hooniverse, you know, there's an imagined universe that's consistent in which all these stories take place. Moffat absolutely not only doesn't care about that, but is its active enemy.
I think he's meta-ing the Doctor and the construction of the last 30 years of something of Doctor Who, in that you just keep forgetting your own past obliquely and very quickly.
Yeah. Mm. I also think calling the Doctor back into existence is what they've been doing for the last five, six years.
How generous of the BBC to fund so much fan fiction. Because that's all this is to me, really. I have to say it out loud. When someone says, do you watch Doctor Who? I go, oh, yes, I just watched Seeds of Doom the other day. And well, what? that is Doctor Who. Go on.
The way Matt underplays that scene.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah.
Is beautiful. It's tempting to make the joke that Tennant would have done it with lots of teeth breathing and what have you. But Tennant was capable of underplaying things, like in Gridlock when he's talking about Gallifrey. But even that is kind of heightened compared to what Matt Smith is doing here. Matt Smith here, he's talking about sacrificing himself to save Amy's parents, whom he has never met.
Plus the universe.
Plus obviously. The universe. But there's no, I could have done so much more. There's no, I don't want to go. There is, this is the right thing to do and I'm the only one capable of doing it and you're going to have a wonderful life.
It's also like that 12-minute speech earlier on. You know, 12 minutes left to live. Oh, you can do a lot in 12 minutes, very short bath. You know, like there's no kind of mopey weepiness about all of that. Mm. It's refreshing. We're about 17 minutes or something like that from the end of the episode, mm-hmm. and, you know, everything's resolved and back to normal. So the plot has ended in a sense, but the story hasn't ended. And so the next 7 minutes, we rewind through the Doctor's life. But it's not really the Doctor's life that we rewind through, is it? It's Amy's story.
Yeah.
And it's the story of this season. And he explicitly says, actually, I'm popping off before we get to the end of time part two. Thanks.
But no fairs, no. But then we go back to the forest in Flesh and Stone with that particular scene that seemed out of place at the time, or not as avid fans would know. And we go back, obviously, to Amelia's house the night she waited for the Doctor.
And he came.
And
he actually came and put her to bed.
And that is the scene that makes me ugly cry every time when he puts her to bed and tells her a story and then says, I don't belong here anymore, I'm going to go.
Yeah, it's so beautifully done. And it's played, it's absolutely played, like this is his last speech before he goes. Mm. But we later discover there's another meaning to that story because he tells the story of the TARDIS and does the most clever thing with it, I think.
Which is?
Well, you know, there's something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, that old wedding thing, as Rory calls it. You know, we all know that. And applying that to the TARDIS is so perfect. And I don't know of anyone having done it before.
No, and it's so obvious.
It's so obvious when you see it. And that's what's so good about Moffat at his best, I think.
It's so obvious when you see it, but you would never have thought of it yourself.
Yeah.
That last bit where Matt is talking to young Amelia and says, like, we're all stories in the end, and then says, you know, daft old man who stole a magic box. I think that's the first time in You Who that it's actually really vocalized that he stole a box, you know.
Yeah.
Like universe lore.
Because we've been highlighting Billy Hartnell all season, haven't we? As in going back to Origins, this is the first time in the series, possibly since Five Doctors, that we've had First Doctor explicitly shown on screen and discussed. I'm talking about his library card.
Yeah.
Just assume everybody's. Just goes back and watches that constantly. I do. I got a heart leap. You and I talked about this, Todd, back in the day when that was first on 2000 and whatever this is. I'm just like, he's back. Really made me feel, it's definitely an origin season.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the borrowing. I mean, that was something that the Doctor used to say, but I don't think has said in the new series about the TARDIS. And so it was always something borrowed.
Yeah. And he even then says to Amelia, and therefore us, did I ever tell you I stole it? I was always going to return it. You know, so it's Moffat does all these knowing winks to the audience. By the time we get to Capaldi, like, Capaldi actually delivers a fair chunk of dialogue down the camera in a couple of episodes. But it's fine by then, because we know that that's what this era does. The Doctor will occasionally tell the companion things that he's directly telling us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the scene ends beautifully as well when he decides to go into the crack, and we don't see him do it. We just see it's a shadow play on the wall. You see the light coming from the crack, mm-hmm. and then you see Matt's sort of figure heading towards it. And it would have looked stupid if you'd seen it, but that actually looks really beautiful, I think. And then we look at the – once he does that, we look at the window and the stars are all back. The
stars are all back.
Yeah.
And the world is at rights, and we get to see Amy's mum and tiny little dad for a few scenes, and Stephen's not interested in exploring them ever again. So this is their moment to shine.
Yes, it was my little one moment of having a mother in this whole season, and you know how much I love that. And
it does go beautifully, doesn't it?
Do you think she's good? She's a little bit like Amy with her husband. You know, your father made the breakfast so you can tip it out the window if it's an atrocity. I just think it's tremendous.
Now, could we have had a whole series next year with them in the background as doting grandparents? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, they would have worked. I think Pong. Brian Williams works quite well as a father in Series 7.
Yeah.
We've got Toby Haynes directing, who yep. we like. What else has he done? He's done Sherlock and Being Human and Black Mirror. So, yeah, it's very – and something's called Jonathan Strange and Dr. Norrell, which I love the book. I haven't seen it as a telling show.
It's Peter Harness, a Doctor Who's Peter Harness who writes it.
What do we think about the direction of this one?
Oh, I think it's stunning.
Yeah. I think it's very tight, and it's a very – and you all touched on it. It's a really difficult piece to direct successfully.
Yeah, well, it is four people speaking in a museum, you know, four and a half people and a Dalek chatting in a museum. It's tough to make interesting.
Yeah, and you've got the same scenes repeated in different sequences, so you need to film them at the same time and make sure that all the angles and perspectives all work
yeah.
in that editing sequence.
Script editor Lindsay Alford has no entry on Wiki or anything else. I'm considering that Lindsay probably
had a breakdown.
Compressed a quantum singularity this season.
Yes. Yeah.
I will say regarding the direction, I wasn't going to bring this up because it's a bit of a nitpick, but at around 13 minutes and 35 seconds, when Amy is doing the sort of height comparison with Amelia, there is actually a person.
Ooh.
Just in the right of shot who realizes the camera has pulled out and gets out of the way. And I did think, is it security guard Rory? But with Amy's eyeline, she would have seen him. It's a member of the crew.
Okay.
Who, unfortunately, and they could have digitally painted them out. Like, it's literally just the camera's pulling back their, like, a finger's width into the screen as you're looking at the screen, and then they go.
So do you think it's the person with the clipboard in Earthshock doing a set tour?
Yeah, it's Val McCrimmon. Yeah.
Oh, I'm on camera again.
Yes, but look, yes, aside from that, Toby Haynes does this very deftly. He was a Doctor Who fan. He had a subscription to Doctor Who magazine. Yeah, and, you know, he did all the wonderful stuff in Stonehenge last week and, of course, Foamhenge just down the road.
I like how some of the stuff in the wedding is actually filmed, like, you know, with River slowly walking past the windows, although I still don't get how she's there to give the diary so she remembers the Doctor as well. Is that just a space reason or total event collapse?
Total event collapse. Yeah. And the book is blank. It's empty. Mm. And I love, again, it's just a moment of absolute magic where she's crying. And we had this in Vincent and we had it last week where Amy is crying because there's someone who's not here who she doesn't even properly remember.
But at the same time, he makes a joke out of it. Like, you know, happy Mrs. Rory. No, I'm sad. Great. You know, you're affected and then you've got a bit of witticism. But maybe it's the whole thing that, you know, Amy remembers the Doctor, and when he comes back into existence, then River from the future knows what's going on, so she comes back
to make it happen.
Just before to make it happen, another loopy thing. I don't know. It I'm happens, just grasping at straws.
It happens because it looks fantastic. and there's the slow motion, like the tear drops, you know, so it's absolutely magic. You know, magic uses blood and tears and things that represent things. You know, it's her tear falls onto something that represents the TARDIS, that represents the Doctor's absence from the story. All of those things happen, and that's when she gets up and gives her speech. And her speech is absolutely superb. It's only then that we get something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, isn't it? And then she yells at it. So good. Like, she gets up to go on about her imaginary friend. Aunt Sharon's there rolling her eyes, you know. The mum is...
Not this again.
Yeah.
I was plastic. You know, you get to see the bow tie and the...
Little shots of things that remind her of him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Doctor did exist as the Raggedy Man, as her imaginary friend in this version of reality. It's just that he wasn't real.
What do you think about, like, Amy saying you may definitely kiss the bride? Like, do you like that line?
Yes, I do.
See, I don't. Come on, just give it up, girl, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, you're married now. And like, he makes it quite clear. No, I'll leave that up to Mr. Pond, and now it's... Mr. Pond, and like, we're always like so complicit, and it's, you know, you're talking about, you know, it's all about getting married, but in the end, he's taking on her name, like,
because she's the star. It's her name in the credits at the beginning. At the moment, Arthur Darvill's not in them, therefore,
this is the Diary of a Fangirl, isn't it? If Billy Piper had been playing it, it's rather than a call girl,
but it's so wonderful. That sort of thing is, it doesn't work like that because, you know, the Doctor doesn't understand things like pregnancy or football or anything like that. It doesn't work like that, Doctor. And he just goes, yeah, it does. And Rory goes, yeah, it does. You know, and so all of that stuff about having a snog in the bushes with Matt, or you may definitely kiss the bride, like, there's no doubt, though, that it's Rory. She's absolutely in love with Rory, and she's just being kind of slightly sexually aggressive in a funny way. And so it post Me Too, that sort of comedy sexual aggression, you know, it's a little bit less problematic coming from a woman. But I do think in terms of Moffat's, you know, 90s rom-com sitcom background, it's fun. It's intended to be fun. I don't think that we're supposed to think that Amy will cheat on her husband or anything like that. We never imagine that for a second.
No. I mean, I do agree. I just kind of think, oh.
I'm kind of with you, Todd, in that just by the time we get here, we've done this joke.
Yeah.
We've done this joke several times over the season.
Except that she does want to have sex with him at the end of Legend's Time.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't think you'd necessarily show evolution by doing the same joke again and say, oh, but this time we're kidding. Yeah. You well, know what I mean?
That's growth.
Oh, dear. I mean, it's a minor blip. And the fact of the matter is Matt's response to it is hilarious.
Yeah.
And Rory's response to the comment later, it's my wedding, I can do what I want. Our wedding.
I like how he's brushing his teeth, but he's dressed for the wedding. Like, he completely gets dressed, puts his tie on, his thing, his little corsage thing, and then decides, oh, I better brush my teeth. I think...
To be honest, when I brush my teeth in the morning, I'm usually fully dressed as well. Because I hate brushing my teeth, so I always put it off.
But I would get it down my front.
Oh, well, that's the thing. I sort of... You can't see me, listener, but I'm jutting my chin forward. I sort of lean forward like
that's
that.
That's why morning suits and dinner jackets have little... Beeps, little bits.
That's the toothpaste.
Yeah. That's why they're white and shiny.
In the end, the Doctor only came for the dancing.
It's so good.
And his dancing is hilarious.
Every
with the kids.
Boy's dancing.
He just works so well with children. Like, Matt just has that energy with them. But then you get that, but then you take that to the TARDIS, like with River and his conversation. Like, did you dance? You know?
Yeah.
Are you married? Are you asking? Yes.
Well, the yes, enigmatic thing that we had, you know, at the end of Flesh and Stone, where the Doctor asks River, can I trust you? And her response is, if you like, which I just think is wonderful. And here she literally just gives nothing at all away, but it is absolutely 100% clear that the only possible non-stupid resolution to this mystery is yes, she is the doctor's wife.
So we're now in the TARDIS, off on new adventures with Amy and Rory. They appear like from their wedding. And do we have something about the silence? I'm quite confused.
Yeah, so the doctor's like, we still don't know why the TARDIS exploded. It's something to do with the silence. The silence are out there, and now I need to get the phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we do get that end of season comedy moment. You know, there's a Egyptian goddess loose on the Orient Express in space, and I fully expected that's what we were going to get for
Christmas.
Yeah.
I think we end up getting something a lot better. It's a sort of funny sitcom line to emphasize they're off on new adventures. But the bit that I like is the moment when they say this is time to say goodbye because she's married. Her story is finished. She is like Vicky or Leela or Susan.
Once a woman marries, she's dead.
Yeah, or Joe, you have to leave the series once you're married. And Stephen subverts that. And this is also the first time where Rory willingly participates. And so they both go out. You know, she goes out to say goodbye. Yes, it's time to say goodbye, but it's time to say goodbye to Ledworth. And it is that usual thing of having people say things that means something different from what we expect. So we are sort of tricked for a moment into thinking that this is goodbye, but of course it's not goodbye to the thing that we thought it was.
And thanks to Russell, we've come to expect that the companion leaves in episode 13.
Yeah.
Especially if they have something to leave to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Martha leaves to look after her family. Amy and Rory are married. They're going to go off and have some boring children.
Yeah.
But no, they're still going to fly off into time and space.
They might not be boring.
They just might be a puddle of stick on the floor. But anyway.
More of that next year.
Sorry.
Yes, it doesn't go well.
No, it's a bit of a disaster. But I just think that this is an absolute high point. We get the hero music coming in at the very end. It's really, truly exciting and satisfying. And it is that thing you said before, Richard, where every previous season finale has been sort of bleak and terrible in some kind of way. And to have this go out on such a high note with the story resolved and something very, very exciting over the horizon. I think it's one of Doctor Who's absolute high points ever. Yeah.
It's the last chapter of this novel.
Yeah. Yes.
Of this particular novel. And it's leaving on a positive because we're going to come back in the sequel.
Yeah.
The sequel novel, more adventures of this TARDIS team.
Of the Tomorrow People.
But it never has been like that, has it? The season has never been.
Might not be again.
I don't think it ever will be again. It's unified and it says something.
What did it get? 6.7 million viewers, audience appreciation of, I think, the highest, 89 or something. Okay, I'm sounding like Todd, but not as informed. It also, because I think I was at the Worldcon this year, I remember getting, this is to the 2011 Hugo Awards presentation, which they have at Worldcon each year. This one won. This script won for, I think it's short performance drama, but it won the Hugo's a big deal. So yeah, it won the Hugo for best short dramatic presentation.
Yeah. It's really something.
I just think it's very cleverly written. It brings everything from this season to most things to a conclusion that, you know, there's still a few things that need to be answered next season, but the majority of Amy's journey to this point, there have been answers for, and it's deeply satisfying. Mm-hmm. I don't know if for Nick whether we've actually explained it. well enough so that, you know,
he
maybe Nick, you've and listeners, you get it a bit more. Mm. I get it a bit more, but then I don't. So I think that's what it's supposed to be, really.
Maybe the explanation was the confusion we all had along the way.
Okay, so it is part two of a two-part story, which means picks of the week. Todd.
Well, I think that I should go with a deeply satisfying season finale that alludes to a marriage and is just going to conclude a season just so wonderfully, like the whole plot lines for the whole season. So I'm going with The Invasion of Time.
I thought so.
From my favourite season of the 1970s.
Brace yourself for the box set.
So please go and watch The Invasion of Time and then come and watch this and tell me which is better.
Yeah, watch it twice.
Mm. I actually love The Invasion.
I do too. I could have nominated the Armageddon factor, but, you know, besides Mary Tam, it's a slog. Yeah,
we like our listeners. Right, my pick of the week is also marriage related. But it's
marriage. It's great.
Yeah. I've just done it for a year. I might keep going. What I'm picking is something we started watching recently. Rod saw it back when it was originally on, and this is my first time watching it. And it shows what might have happened to Amy and Rory had they decided to stay in Ledworth and have two boring children. And I think Richard is going to like this recommendation. It's Butterflies, featuring Wendy Craig and Jeffrey Palmer.
By Carla Lane.
Yeah. Now, I am only halfway through season one, and I have no idea what happens with the relationships that Rhea, the lead, is forming both in her family and outside of her marriage.
Hello, Leonard.
Yeah, hello,
I haven't seen this since it was on.
No, me either, but I did watch it.
Yeah, so I'm only halfway through season one, and I will say, especially for a modern audience expecting a sitcom, there is some confronting language in there and concepts, but it is done with a certain lightness of touch. It also has very young Nicholas Lyndhurst as one of her sons, one of her painfully thin sons, because it's 1978.
Oh, he'd just done The Prince and the Pauper.
Yeah.
If you ever saw that one. He's a good actor right from the word go. Mm. Yeah.
I think it's on BritBox if you want to see it.
Okay.
Yes. So Butterflies.
For me, if you like exploding things and time out of sequence and marriages that you hope will go right but you suspect they won't, I'm really enjoying Disney's The Right Stuff.
Ooh.
I know, shock horror. It's Mad Men in space, and it even has some of the same actors, but it's beautifully done, beautifully written, and it doesn't pull punches. So it's the Thunderbirds crew, as in Scott, John, Alan, Gordon, and Virgil, but they're actually the Mercury astronauts. And considering these are based on real persons and they're only recently deceased, it goes over the complexity. As I said, it's Mad Men with rockets. So it doesn't pull punches with people, with real people's history, but it's very interesting. And it doesn't paint Wernher von Braun in anything but a truthful and historically accurate light. It gets quite dark. I'm really, really enjoying that. And I also grabbed Doctor Who Season 8 Blu-ray off Nathan's shelf because I just think everyone should have one.
Well, I'm going to pick something. I guess we've had sort of rom-com things happening. I'm going to pick a show called Love, Victor, which I don't think I've mentioned before. So you might remember Love, Simon was a film in which a sort of well-off white kid who was gay came out to his parents and nothing really bad happened, and then he got a boyfriend and the whole thing ended. I really liked it. It was a good rom-com. It was sort of fun and sweet, and it was unusual to have just a gay rom-com that isn't about being gay necessarily, but people observed at the time that it was very white and very kind of middle class and stuff. And so there is a sequel TV series. It was originally going to be Disney, but they had a little bit of stage fright about it, and then it was released by Hulu, and it is about a kid who arrives in Atlanta after moving from Texas. His family is Hispanic. They're working class or sort of kind of working class. And he has a much sort of rougher time. And it's slower. It's more complicated. It's got a lovely cast of characters. And I'm a bit of a sucker for TV shows set in schools just because, you know, I'm a school teacher. And it's, again, nice to have a romantic comedy that centers on sort of gay concerns. It's fun. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's quite moving in places as well. This week. We'll be back next week to revel in what might be Doctor Who's most coherent season ever in our Series 5 retrospective. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie Into Terror. Until next time, if something can be remembered, it can come back. So close your eyes, wish really hard, and one day, maybe, we can all sit down together and watch Xenia Merton dancing in Marco Polo Part 3. Oh. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
I'm manifesting my house keys. Good night.
See you soon. Good then.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, The Todd Experience, was recorded on the 16th of May 2021 and released on the 6th of June. Nothing is more ridiculous or miraculous than the continued love and support we receive from our listeners. So this week I'd like to thank Liam McNicholas, who has been releasing incredible artwork every week to accompany our Series 5 episodes. Check him out on Twitter at Liam McNicholas. There'll be a link in this week's show notes.
I don't know why it only says I have 2 hours and 4 minutes left on the for recording.
And you've just cleared the card.
And I've just cleared the entire card. We're not going to go for 2 hours and 4 minutes, are we?
No.
No. Okay, good. All right. I've got Vincent and the Doctor to put out, which means listening to it again. Our title this week, by the way, is Balancing the Darkness, which I think is pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Given the rule that... it has to be the guest on their first appearance.
Yeah.
Okay. So everyone say something funny and compete for the title of this week's one. We've already decided the title for the one that we recorded last week is Space Reasons, because I'm desperate to get Space Reasons to happen. And
oh, yes, we must do that this week.
It was Peter. And I just think Space Reasons is so much better than, like, I was talking about stupid science fiction reasons, but yeah, Space Reasons is space much reasons. Funnier because it's like space corridors.
Yeah. Space Reasons is something you can imagine being set in Lower Decks.
Yes. Yeah.
Dr. Ta'ana, what's caused this virus? Space Reasons.
Well, I mean, I can actually literally hear it happening in Blake 7 Series A with my degree in space critical theory. All right.
Space critical theory. Yeah, it works for me too.
All right. Should we get started? So, I'm going to throw to Todd at the beginning. Todd's going to just start talking at the beginning rather than me throwing to him. Oh, I watched this last night.
Yes.
Likewise. And a week ago and before that. Okay. So, Nathan, Brendan, Todd, Richard, the traditional order. Yeah. There we go.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety.